ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Does the world feel particularly precarious to you right now?
What we're seeing now is all of these swirling currents with dictators and countries like Korea, North Korea feeding the missiles to Russia and China playing a double game with everybody and NATO sort of a bit divided and the Americans divided and Donald Trump, you know, that would be a complete game changer.
It feels to me that the US and the West is in a state of decline and that there is a lot of jostling going on across the global south, and that's what feels really in flux.
If the entire Russian army is a threat of collapse, if the Russian state is a threat of collapse, then I think we face a real prospect of nuclear escalation as a kind of last-ditch effort for the Russians to ensure their own survival.
Hairy, scary times, right? And sobering, really, to think that smaller conflicts than we're witnessing in the world right now have set off world wars. So who will be key to guiding us all through this tense, tumultuous time? What allegiances will really matter? Towards 2030, who will be the world's superpowers, but also the world's super peacemakers? Let's get ahead of these machinations and manoeuvres with a conversation I hosted at the Sorrento Writers' Festival, which the crowds thronged to on Victoria's Mornington Peninsula. Joining me are the multi-Walkley award-winning journalist, seasoned foreign correspondent and the ABC's global affairs editor, John Lyons, whose book Balcony Over Jerusalem, a Middle East memoir, has just been republished with an update. Sam Roggeveen is director of the Lowy Institute's International Security Program and author of The Echidna Strategy, Australia's Search for Power and Peace. Ilaria Walker is the Asia Pacific editor at 360 Info. That's a global public interest journalism initiative at Monash University, which you can find online. So join us for this very illuminating hour.
So an hour to, peer into the crystal ball to 2030. I just want you to start with really just a sentence. What superpowers, what machinations, what dynamics are you watching over the next 5 years? John.
Thanks, Natasha, and thanks everybody for being here. For me, you know, it's not just individual countries at the moment. We're seeing this huge alignment and different alliances are growing up, forming, competing with each other. The world's in a state of flux, the like of which we really haven't seen. We've got China bringing together, brokering a deal, peace deal, if you like, between Iran and Saudi Arabia, something the United States probably would have tried once. You've got regimes, from whether it's China, Russia, North Korea and Iran, are all aligning over Ukraine against the United States. You've got NATO and the US, and you've got US sort of now under pressure to break away from its support for Ukraine. The possibility then of Donald Trump at the end of the year, which would essentially, I think, if he won, would largely mean the end of Ukraine as we know it as a country, because the Russians have taken 20% of Ukraine, and I suspect that Donald Trump would say, let's draw a line under this and go with the boundaries that currently exist, which would lead to internal political chaos within Ukraine. We've seen how fragile Russia is. When Prigozhin and the Wagner group were thinking of marching upon Moscow, we saw the fragility of that. Russia is now changing into a system, or developing a system of private armies, where large companies like Gazprom will have a private army, their security people they call them, as many as 50 or 60,000 people. So what's happening in Russia is now there's alliances between the different private armies, and that all gets back to Ukraine. We're seeing Ukraine losing the war against Russia. There's no doubt about that. And I think you look at America, I think, has been in this situation where it has not wanted Putin to lose because it fears what will come after Putin. It doesn't want Russia to break up into these civil wars between private armies. And then you've got China and the US, that sort of competition. So in all of that mix, I think we've never seen the world in this state of flux.
It's a big answer, and we've got an hour to really explore some of those themes together. And John's actually writing a book about the Russian-Ukraine war at the moment, so watch out for that. Sam, it's hard to do in a sentence, isn't it?
Actually, let me have a go at simplifying it. If the question is about the superpowers out to 2030, then the answer is actually fairly straightforward and predictable. It's the United States and China. There are very few things about international politics that are predictable, and maybe one thing we'll get time for later is to talk about just how terrible people like me are at making accurate predictions about international politics. Our record is absolutely dreadful.
Excellent caveat to make, yeah.
However, there are a handful of things that are entirely predictable about international politics. One is geography, which is immutable. The second is demographics, which can change, but only very, very slowly. And the third is economics, which also can change and maybe slightly more quickly than demographics. But on all those three counts, the United States and China are going to be inevitably the two superpowers in the world in 2030 and for, you know, decades beyond that. And the thing that we in Australia are going to be struggling with in the indefinite future is that the United States has lost that the brief period of supremacy it enjoyed in the Asia-Pacific region, and the region is now going to become much more contested. It already is much more contested. No country of China's size is going to stand for being indefinitely a strategic subordinate of another power in its own backyard. I mean, you only have to reverse the picture to realise how obvious this is. If China had 40,000 troops or 50,000 troops stationed in Canada, or it had a carrier, aircraft carrier stationed in Cuba, for instance, we wouldn't expect the Americans to stand for that. And China's not going to stand for it either. They're going to try in various ways to push the Americans out. That's going to make life much more complicated for Australia. The book I wrote last year actually tries to outline a strategy for how we can cope with that. It's not quite as difficult as it sounds. We're a long way away from China, so we can make that work. But inevitably, our future is going to be much more complicated by a China that is much bigger and an America that will remain incredibly powerful, but in relative terms, is going to go into decline.
Well, you play down the military threat from China, and that's very interesting, and let's explore that. But also you question the value of our allegiance with America in our region as well. So that will be very interesting to explore. Ilaria Walker, what are you watching over the next 5 years?
Well, I would really agree with John that it feels like a very volatile and chaotic and uncertain time. No matter how much you watch these things and read the academic journals and read the news, it feels very hard to unpick it. It feels like there's just so much movement and flux and uncertainty that would be the really defining feature that I feel at the moment about it. Towards 2030, I think, yes, the US and China are the big ones, but if you use some of the metrics that Sam was describing in terms of what makes a superpower, so economy, military influence, and just population size, you'd have to throw India in the mix as well. Its population by 2030 will be bigger than China's, and some people say that its economy will be second to just after China. So there's a lot of people, there's a growing middle class, they're educated, they're a very technophilic culture. So they're very sort of interested in developing skills in sort of technology communications. And there's just heaps of them. So I think that India,
a fifth of the world's population, that's a superpower.
Yeah. And the population's slowing down, but not as much as China's has, right? So one child policy was abolished in 2015, but just culturally, there's just not, people aren't having as many babies in China. And in terms of the military stuff and China, I find it really interesting how the one-child policies played into the willingness of Chinese families to send their sons to war. There's not a huge appetite for it because they've just got these one children, and if they've got a boy, he's sort of so precious that they don't really want to send that child to war. But that said, war isn't really going to be fought by humans in 2030. It'll be a different type of warfare. But yeah. But so I'd put India in the mix. And the one other thing, without banging on, is that I think the global south as an entity is the thing that I really have my eye on. It feels to me that the US and the West is in a state of decline, and that there is a lot of jostling going on across the global south, from China, India, some African countries, South Africa, Nigeria.
And it's how those allegiances are galvanised will be very interesting to
watch. And that's what feels really in flux. Mm. Yeah.
John Lyons, we're talking about the superpowers, but we also want to consider the super peacemakers, don't we, in the coming years and months and days, and particularly in the Middle East. Now, you've spent many years covering the Middle East. I think you've covered all Gaza wars in your lifetime. Who do you see being key? What coalition, what countries, what individuals will be key to negotiating a way through peace in the region and in Gaza and in this current conflict?
Well, Natasha, I think at the moment what's happening in the Middle East is essentially the big underlying conflict is Israel versus Iran. That underwrites a lot of what's happening. And only last week, of course, we've seen the first direct attacks by Iran on Israel, and then Israel responding. And look at all the conflicts in the Middle East at the moment. There's the Houthis firing at ships in the Red Sea. That's obviously related to Iran. Iran supports the Houthis. There's Hezbollah in the south of Lebanon. They have as many as 150,000 missiles in the south of Lebanon, south of the Litani River, all pointing in one direction, not north, but south into Israel. And what we saw in the last week or two was just a bit of shots across the bows.
Tit for tat.
Just both sides sending a message to the other one that we can do something. As I mentioned earlier, the alliances, although the world has been, a lot of parts of the world have been sort of critical of the Gaza war, what suddenly happened when Iran fired drones and missiles at Israel, suddenly there was an instant coalition. Jordan, Egypt, United Arab Emirates, UK, all sending up jets to shoot down the drones. The drones can take hours to get from Iran all the way into Israel. So these jets were literally flying the skies over Syria and Jordan and pinging one by one. So suddenly there was a new alliance supporting Israel. And it's all about the fear of the US, the great fear of the US and Israel is Iran getting a nuclear weapon. So what I think we'll see in coming weeks and months, I think we'll see a lot more attacks by Israel, isolated attacks on Iran, trying to hit those nuclear facilities. Israel's frustration at the moment is a lot of those nuclear facilities being developed in Iran are well below ground, around Natanz and places. The Israelis are desperate to get bunker buster bombs. They don't have them. They want them from the US. Joe Biden won't give them. Perhaps Donald Trump will. And they are bombs, obviously, as the name suggests, that can go 20, 30 metres below ground and try to blow up those nuclear facilities. If that were to happen, then I think Iran would activate Hezbollah. That's their trump card.
As their proxy.
That's Iran's big trump card. Mm. And although the Iron Dome...
Would that trip it into a regional war?
Yeah, it would. That's the worst-case scenario. That's a full-on war. And although Israel has extraordinary technology with the Iron Dome system, which intercepts most rockets that come from Gaza...
And you've been there as that system has worked around you in Jerusalem.
And you see them. I mean, we were at dinner one night in Bethlehem, out in the open. It was a beautiful evening, and we saw this missile flying in from Gaza. And then about 30 seconds later, you see a second missile come. That's the Israeli missile chasing the missile from Gaza, and then you see them catch up with each other, and then bang, that explodes, and then you get the thud of that metal. The Iron Dome system is the moment a rocket is fired from Gaza, within seconds, the Israeli computer system can predict its trajectory. So we'll then fire up a missile that will, in 1 minute and 10 seconds, be at that point. And if it misses, then the Israeli missile will then change direction. But if you have 150,000 missiles coming in at once, Israel can't cope with that. So that's the worst case scenario.
So thinking about superpowers and relationships, back to that question about super peacekeepers, who would negotiate an Oslo Accord type situation or a two-state solution in the region in such a chaotic situation?
I think America's credibility in the Middle East now is zero. Even the Israelis are attacking them. The coalition members, the hardline right-wingers, are now branding Joe Biden as an anti-Semite because he wants to sanction some hardline settler groups. So to answer your question, I think the leader in the Middle East who has the most credibility is Emmanuel Macron. Who would have thought that the French president would emerge? I think the Turks have a certain purchase. The Chinese are more and more active. When I was in Ukraine, the Chinese are actually sending, you know, negotiators between Kyiv and Moscow. And again, that's a role the US would have once had. So you're seeing this incredible emergence of China as perhaps wanting to play this role, whether they can or not, who knows. So you have the nuclear threat with both Iran and Russia. The reason that the US won't provide, hasn't provided Ukraine with what it needs, F-16s in particular, is their fear that Putin will respond with a nuclear weapon. And so that makes, in my view, it makes Russia a bit of a superpower, that we can do whatever we want. We can take 20% of Ukraine and get away with it. Iran wants to be able to do whatever it wants. And that's the new fear.
The nuclear threat lives on, as it did all through our childhood in the Cold War. Sam Roggeveen, China and our region. There's a really interesting article in the New York Times this morning outlining military strategy, US military strategy in the region. How do you see this tension between China as an economic power, but China's growing military power as well? How do you read their motivation around military build-up?
I tried to read it, but the firewall stopped me, so I couldn't couldn't get to it this morning. But I think what the article is describing, as I understood it, is the development of American defence posture in Asia in response to China's military build-up. And quite a bit's been happening over the last few years, particularly in regard to basing. So a new agreement for four new bases in the Philippines, a more minor agreement with Papua New Guinea, and, of course, Australia. So the government announced a year or so ago that Australia would host, the word base has never been used, but, you know, it's very close to being a base. We're going to host American strategic bombers at RAAF Tyndall in the north of Australia. And we're also going to host American nuclear-powered submarines at HMAS Stirling in Western Australia. So for the first time, we'll have operational American military assets on Australian soil. So it's not training, it's not exercising. It is operational assets, which means if there's a war, there'll be wartime missions fought, deployed from those two facilities. And that means, inevitably, that those facilities on Australian soil will be targets. But I think there is a little bit less to this than I think the Americans themselves would suggest. So what we're seeing is a spreading of American resources around the region. What we haven't seen lately, what we haven't seen, in fact, since the end of the Cold War, is a massive expansion of American military force in our region. And that's the most important thing. You would think
so that the talk is tougher than the bite, in a sense.
Yes, right. Absolutely. And you would think that after, you know, an unprecedented now 35-year expansion of military power that the Chinese have undergone, the most dramatic modernization of any military force since the Second World War, you would think that if the Americans were truly serious about defending their status as the leading power in Asia, that they would have responded to that by now. But if you look at the actual number of forces and the capability of forces the Americans have deployed in Japan, in Korea, in Hawaii, Guam, etc., it really hasn't changed that much since the end of the Cold War.
And that's what's going on there?
I think ultimately it's a lack of resolve on the Americans' part. I don't question American bravery or American character. I'm merely making a judgment about US interests. China is the single biggest adversary the US has ever taken on in its time as a superpower, far bigger already than the Soviet Union ever was. To take on an adversary like that, you need to have a really good reason. You need an existential reason. And for all China's power, it doesn't represent an existential threat to the US. It certainly represents a threat to America's status in Asia. But that's not enough to fight you know, the biggest war that the US has ever fought against China. So I think ultimately it's American resolve that's in question here. And that's why, in turn, I think Australia and other allies in the region, American allies in the region, need to think, well, will the Americans actually be there for us when, you know, at our darkest moment?
And you don't think they necessarily will?
No. So I think the Ukraine war actually provides a useful example here. So the Taiwanese, I reckon, would be watching this very closely, right? So if you look at the analogy, you have a nuclear-armed great power invading a smaller country on its borders. And what do? The Americans have provided copious numbers of weapons. They provided diplomatic support. They've provided sanctions and other forms of economic support. But have the Americans sent troops in? Has NATO sent troops in? Absolutely not. That's always been a red line from the beginning. And I think the Taiwanese will be watching that and saying, this is our future, the Ukrainification of America's alliance network in Asia.
China is dependent on a trade relationship with the USA, as it is indeed on Australia. I mean, and the US is dependent on a trade. The world is dependent on its trade relationship with China. Is trade, is that economic relationship a great pacifier, or we've also seen it play a role as a form of economic coercion, haven't we? Certainly in its relationship with China's relationship with Australia. That tension really interests me, how that will play out in a globalised world over the next 5 years.
This is a debate that goes all the way back to the 19th century and even before, when, you know, liberal internationalists in Britain in that period of, you know, that Industrial Revolution period said that, you know, trade was the antidote to war.
Mm.
And of course, you know, Europe was no more integrated economically and socially than it was before the First World War. And then look what happened, right? So there was free labour flows across borders before the First World War. For instance, Europe was incredibly integrated, and yet, you know, they still descended into the horror of the Great War. I don't want to dismiss the argument that trade helps to alleviate the motivations for war. I think the other effect of trade, though, is that it creates spheres of influence. So particularly around China's periphery, I think we already see the beginnings of a Chinese sphere of influence on mainland Southeast Asia. Laos and Cambodia, for instance, are now, I think, pretty clearly part of a Chinese sphere of influence, and it'll be one thing we've got to watch very carefully is how much further that expands.
Ilaria Walker, how should we think about and read China's play in the Pacific? A huge investment in our neighbouring Pacific islands and communities. Some governments have lent right into that relationship, others have done it cautiously, but everywhere you look, China is investing major infrastructure, building those relationships, sending in workers, sending in the dongas to house them. Like, it's an extraordinary play that's going on. How are you analysing that relationship?
Look, it's a great question. I try to look at it from the perspective of the Pacific Islanders themselves, who I think their voices are often really lost in this. As Sam has really argued really well, you know, China and America are and will continue to be the biggest players. Geographically, the Pacific Islands are scattered in that enormous expanse of ocean and provide, you know, really important footing for military bases and for influence.
Well, China's built, hasn't it, built 2 to 3 synthetic islands or for military operations?
More than that, but there are 3 that are particularly well-developed as military bases,
yeah.
Yes.
Fascinating. Ilaria?
Yeah, so look, I think, you know, I think we all tend to look at this geopolitics through the lens of the powerful, and I think that makes sense because they have so much ability to impact. You know, they have power, they'll decide what happens and what doesn't happen. But I really try to see it from the perspective of those people that live on those islands who, they've got their own worldview, their own culture. They will act in their own best interests. So I think that we can go in and think, oh, you know, to try and get their alliance because we want it for our own good, but, you know, in the end, I don't love that, and I don't think that they love it either, seeing them being seen as these pawns to be
puppets
to be toyed with for whoever can give them. But yeah, so I see it a bit on that level. Pacific Island Islander people and Melanesian people care a lot about climate in a way that a lot of people don't realise. It's a really existential issue for the people there.
And the next 5 years is certainly when, you know, we can't just talk about economic security, we can't talk about military might, we have to talk about climate security in the next 5 years.
Yeah, exactly. And so I think that, you know, they take quite seriously the commitments that people make on that front, and that does inform their decisions about, you know, how to ally themselves. I think culturally, they have maybe more in common with the West than they do with China. And I think that that can really play a role on the ground. There can be hostility to Chinese influence and Chinese culture on that grassroots level. They're Christian people in that part of the world. They feel a lot of common ground with other Christian nations. They're interested in rugby, and, you know, it's sort of culturally, I think that that part of the world has maybe more in common with the West. Yeah.
India's going to the vote, massive, massive exercise, Indian elections, a sort of rolling vote. How do you read India under Narendra Modi and what will play out there? I mean, a lot of countries are courting India, but it seems to be very piecemeal, I guess. I'm not a strategist about the region, but I'm interested in your reading of how Narendra will play things out, what relationships he will build. And he, you know, I don't think we fully appreciate the increasing tilt towards authoritarianism in India. And I've just observed that one of our colleagues, our Southeast Asia correspondent, has just been, her visa was compromised in India.
Yeah, that's right. Avani Diaz, the ABC correspondent, had to leave.
Yeah. So, look, so the Indian election's underway right now. It's the largest democratic exercise of all time. It's apparently the largest peacetime logistical exercise of all time. There are 960 million voters, which is a bigger number than all the other enormous elections that have happened this year, including...
And more voters than ever before, I think.
Yeah. So bigger than the US, Indonesia, Bangladesh, Mexico, South Africa combined. It's just an enormous, enormous democratic exercise. It's got a really high turnout, or it did last time they went to the polls. So it's quite an energised electorate. Narendra Modi is wildly popular. It's very hard for us to understand a politician that has an approval rating in the 70s, which you just 60s or 70s, you couldn't believe it. It just would never happen in a Western country.
So how is he using that popularity?
So he's a Hindu nationalist. So 80% of Indian people identify as Hindu, and then the rest are either Muslim or Christian or a mixture of other things. And he's just really, really energised this understandable post-colonial identity politics around Hinduism. Maybe it would have started as a backlash against British colonialism, and people have really lent into their Hinduism. But he's really made it into, at some times, quite a violent xenophobic movement that's very hostile to Muslim people in particular and other minorities. He has really leaned into being quite an authoritarian leader. India doesn't have press freedom. It locks up its journalists all the time. It sends the ones that it doesn't like away, like it did at the ABC. You're not allowed to ask Modi a question. Nobody asks Modi any questions, which is just another thing that's really hard for us to understand in the West. A lot of people on the Indian progressive side, or Muslim Indians, are really worried about Modi, particularly in the south. Places like Kerala are a lot more highly educated and affluent, and so they're really worried about it. But the truth is, they love him. Indian people are pretty united behind Modi, and the opposition's pretty decimated.
Just thinking about the global play, there has been a tilt towards authoritarianism. The last 10 years has seen a drop in the number of liberal democracies in the world, and that's a serious question for our immediate future. And so how do you consider that?
Well, I think that at times of real volatility, at times when people are feeling really under threat and insecure, there's an appeal to authoritarian populist leaders who just want to take charge and get things done. You've seen that really across the globe, from, you know, India to the US to Eastern Europe. It's really everywhere, with a few notable exceptions, people that have, you know, turned back the tide. I can't see that changing.
The point, though, take charge and get things done. The question is, what do they get done, and in whose interests? John Lyons, then, thinking about back to Europe, the countries adjacent to Ukraine at the moment are very anxious. There's a real concern that there'll be a spillover of Russia's assault on Ukraine, isn't there?
That's right. Ironically, Vladimir Putin, who went to war largely because he and the Russians thought NATO was encroaching on their borders, Vladimir Putin's been the single best recruiter for NATO the world has seen. I went about a year ago to cover a NATO conference in Vilnius, and I met this young Lithuanian guy who said to me, listen, if you really want to understand where we're coming from, go and have a look at the KGB museum in the centre of the city. So I broke away for a couple of hours and went and had a look at this KGB museum. And, you know, it's got all the horrors of the dungeons and the, you know, this was the KGB when they were ruling the old Soviet Union. And there was one particular room where, you know, it got worse and worse as you went in. And one of them had a little circle, and the rest of the room was filled with water. And so the prisoner, the political prisoner, would have to sort of sit or stand on this one tiny circle. And of course, when they fell asleep, next thing they're falling into freezing water, and the various torture techniques. And this young guy said to me, when you go there, you'll understand how we see Russia, our fear. And they're falling over themselves in Europe to join NATO, whether it's Sweden and everybody else. And I think for years, NATO was seen as sort of a bit, you know, had it outlived its usefulness, etc. But now, if you can get a ticket to NATO, to join NATO, it's wonderful, because in a way you see the rampaging sort of Russia coming across, and Ukraine, of course, not being a member. And now you've got countries like Moldova, and Russia is not only threatening them, but there's lots of things going on internally where Russia is running big sort of internal campaigns of fear and violence.
And you saw that mass exodus of journalists, artists, activists. Yeah. They had to get out when Russia attacked Ukraine. I remember speaking to a science journalist who had escaped with his entire, 30 members of his family. And it's terrifying for people. We're not hearing those stories. The tragedy is that the ABC doesn't have a correspondent in Russia at the moment.
We'd love to get in there. Yeah. I've had several meetings with the Russian ambassador, but we can't get in there at the moment. But you're seeing now European countries fearful that should Donald Trump be elected, and even if he doesn't, the sort of the Republican rump saying, let's pull back from NATO, let's stop funding them. Now, that's why Emmanuel Macron and a lot of the European leaders are now talking about, why don't we have a European-wide army? And so all of these alliances are changing by the week.
Sam?
Well, because we don't have much insight into Russia these days, we forget how phlegmatic the Russians themselves are, and how, you know, they have bullshit detectors as well. Mm. They don't believe everything Putin tells them. And because John mentions the KGB, it gives me a chance to tell a joke that Russians used to tell each other during the Cold War. The question is, why do KGB officers always work in teams of three? And the answer is, one of them can read, one of them can write, and the third one's there to keep an eye on the two intellectuals.
You just were hanging to tell that, weren't you? Has the war in Ukraine weakened Putin or strengthened him? How do you read his next move? He seems impenetrable. This is why I want correspondence in Russia. I want to know what's going on.
I don't know the answer to that, but I do know that we need to be careful about what we wish for with regard to Putin, because any time that this conflict in Ukraine does become existential for him personally, that's when we need to worry most about nuclear escalation. And so the very careful balancing act that the Western powers have been trying to play here, led, I think, very adroitly by President Biden is to give the Ukrainians enough to stave off the Russian attacks, and even help the Ukrainians to win, but always with the caveat that, yes, we want Ukraine to win, but not by too much. If the Ukrainians win by too much, if the entire Russian army is at threat of collapse, if the Russian state is at threat of collapse, then I think we face a real prospect of nuclear escalation as a kind of last-ditch effort for the Russians to ensure their own survival. I think John's point earlier about Ukraine and that the Ukrainians are losing suggests that maybe we're not getting that balance quite right anymore. But that is something that is very much top of mind in the White House, and I'm all of us should be very pleased that it is.
John, you're thinking about this a lot, and it's devastating really to hear that this dance between political ego and nuclear threat is still alive and well in the world.
Yeah, I mean, as Sam says, it is the President Biden is having to keep all of this in mind. The world doesn't want to see the collapse of Russia at the moment for various reasons, with those private armies taking over, and then who controls the nuclear arsenal if you've got private armies taking over. So to answer your question about Putin, I think he thought it would be quick. He thought they'd march into Kyiv within days. They almost did. The Ukrainians put up an amazing sort of counter-offensive. Then there was the big
build-up. An incredible diplomacy on behalf of its president.
I mean, when you drive into Kyiv, what really shocked me the first time was, as you're driving into the city, how close the Russians got. They were within 2 or 3 or 4 kilometres. They were almost in Kyiv, right? And the Ukrainians did an amazing job at pushing them out. Then there was the big build-up to the counter-offensive. Meanwhile, it's about a, 1,500-kilometre front line. It took 8 or 10 months for the Ukrainians to do that counteroffensive. That gave 8 or 10 months for the Russians to fortify that part of land there. It's probably the most fortified land. Ukrainians realised they couldn't go by land, and the West has limited the number of their long-term missiles because the West... This is an incredible defensive war. What they're getting at the moment is more self-defence batteries. And when I was in Kyiv, every few hours the siren goes off and you run down to the bomb shelter. Now the missiles are getting through. And the Russians are using the Kinzhal missiles, more and more brutal missiles. Mm. But they're not firing back really into Russia or Crimea. And so that's why the Ukrainians are fighting with one hand tied behind their back.
Lesser things than what we're seeing in the Middle East and what we're seeing in Ukraine right now have triggered world wars.
Yeah, look, the world is at a very, very sort of precarious position, I think. I think we took for granted periods of instability through much of the last few decades. In a way, that was an aberration. And what we're seeing now is all of these swirling currents with dictators and countries like Korea, North Korea feeding the missiles to Russia, and China playing a double game with everybody, and the NATO sort of a bit divided, and the Americans divided, and Donald Trump, that would be a complete game changer. Who knows what would that
be? Lingering on stage left. We are going to leave you with some hope at the end of this session, just so you know, so you're not... But you knew what you were getting yourself in for, right? Ilaria Walker, I think we'd be remiss not to consider other types of power that are of the super variety in the world. And I think that power certainly is manifesting in big tech, who seem to be operating in their own sphere and yet wielding incredible control, including what countries around the world see and hear about the machinations of the world, as John aptly described in terms of media censorship in the region that you've been covering. But how do you see big tech as a superpower?
Yeah, that's a great question, but I don't know if it fits into the framing of the question, which is about optimism.
That's later. We're coming to optimism. All right. Hold hope.
Although, you know what? I will actually try and take an optimistic view of big tech. The framing of it is bad in that big tech, I don't think that they're good guys. They are self-interested, and their primary objective is about the acquisition of money and power and people's private data. They're not out there to do good in the world, regardless of how they frame things around free speech or social justice or whatever. I just don't think...
Well, that's palpably bullshit, isn't it? Because at the moment their algorithms are also filtering out content that they consider to be political in the middle of major conflicts.
Yeah, exactly. So I think on the bad side, there's that. And as we're seeing now with Elon Musk versus Australia, they're more powerful than democratically elected nations. They can overrule the will of prime ministers of democratically elected nations. So on that front, that is really bad. Their algorithms are not designed to be helpful or to do social good. Their algorithms are designed to keep you on the platform. They're very, they're designed to be addictive. They feed you more and more extreme versions of what your pre-existing biases already are. So they create...
By design.
By design. They want to keep you there. They want to engage you with content that makes you angry and upset and that feeds into your... what you already think, but makes it more extreme. So I think the way that it's currently working is not good because it fuels polarisation and it gives power to people who haven't been elected and who are not good guys. So, you know...
On the other hand, much of the... Given that Western journalists haven't been getting into Gaza, many Gaza-based journalists and citizens, and I note that a citizen-turned-correspondent on Instagram just been nominated for a Peabody, a young 25-year-old woman who's Palestinian living in Gaza with bombs going off around her.
That is such a good point, and that was where I think maybe the optimism comes from, is that the gatekeepers, the traditional gatekeepers of information and what's true, which was the traditional or legacy media, they are almost irrelevant in a lot of parts of the world now. People don't get their news, unfortunately, from the ABC anymore. They get it from...
Well, they do.
They do,
They still
course.
Get it from the ABC.
But they might get it from the ABC's Instagram account.
They
might get it from the ABC's Instagram account. You know, like people in a lot of parts of the world are getting their news, their media from social media, which, as I said, is problematic. But then you do get people like Bizan, who was the Palestinian journalist who was in Gaza when all the other journalists were being blocked from going there or they were killed. I think it's almost 100 journalists have now been killed in Gaza.
136.
I've seen people my age and younger, particularly younger than me, accessing those reports from the ground in Gaza in a way that people have never seen before. People have never seen war broadcast from the ground by citizens before. I find it a very unsettling and upsetting experience myself to see those first-hand accounts of what's going on there, but
yeah,
they
some
can't...
of the footage. I mean, baby, the baby just... being ripped from her dead mother revived from her womb. You know, last week was the most extraordinary and devastating footage to see.
But at least we're seeing it, right? And so I think that is a big change, and so governments and people that have particular interests are less able to control the narrative. And I got to say, the narrative around the Palestinians has completely changed. And I don't think it's just because of the brutality of this particular war. I think it's because people were able to see what was happening from the ground in a way that they haven't really been able to do before.
Mm. This panel also has a sense of optimism. We had a lot of email exchange this week and we landed at a point of optimism, which I thought was very interesting. So let's explore where you hold optimism, where you hold hope. But in parallel, I guess I want to throw a double header at you. And what role for citizens? Because it's very easy for us to all feel disempowered when we think about the machinations of the superpowers and the major players. Are we a major player in any way, shape or form, John?
Well, I think the first thing we need to do is to protect Australian democracy, and that means being engaged and voting and taking part in it and ensuring violence and extremism doesn't take off and jumping on that when we can. It's the role of the media as well there, because we can't take anything for granted in the world in which we live. If Donald Trump becomes the President of the United States, and we know a lot of his instincts, he didn't want to leave office the first time. If he gets elected, who knows, will he want to leave office the second time? So we have to ensure that at least our little patch here is peaceful and well-functioning and, you know, respects everybody and different people. My one sort of point of optimism would be that the Israeli-Palestinian issue, which shadows so many other things, can be solved. As battered and bruised as the two-state solution idea is, I think it's the only hope, it's the only solution. And I think the fact that people are talking about it more than ever before is a good sign, essentially. But it requires Israel, the Americans, to encourage Israel to end the military occupation in the West Bank, and it requires the Palestinians to force and pressure Hamas out of the system so that the extremists inside the Palestinian sector are marginalised. And we have an extremist government as well in Israel at the moment. Recently I did a Four Corners program where the former head of Shin Bet, Ami Alon, described two of the leaders of the coalition in the Israeli government as terrorists. That's the former head of security talking.
It's an extraordinary Four Corners. Please watch it on iView if you've missed it. Sam?
Well, I'm optimistic, rationally optimistic. Firstly, about social media, I wrote a little line in the acknowledgements page of my book that I couldn't have written this book without Twitter, but without Twitter, I would have written it in half the time.
Yeah.
But generally, I'm an optimist, and there's been a hovering over this session has been this sense of that we're living through a period of unprecedented instability and danger. Maybe, but I'm not totally convinced. And I think one thing we have to constantly guard against is what's been called the parochialism of the present. Behavioralists refer to it as recency bias, which is when you're looking for evidence to confirm your view of the world, you tend to pluck out the most recent bits of data. But over the long term, actually, you know, global trends are incredibly good. And if you apply, you know, the time machine test, if there was a time machine in the corner of the room that could only take you backwards, not forwards, would any of us go back to any other time? I mean, I suppose that's easy to say from Australian perspective, but of course, globally, extreme poverty is near to elimination. Education levels around the world are higher than they've ever been. People are living longer lives. You know, living standards are on the rise everywhere around the world. I mean, we're at a period of unprecedented wealth and prosperity, so that there's a great deal to be optimistic about.
Yeah, and we had a bit of an exchange behind the scenes. Stephen Pinker, in his book, The Better Angels of Our Nature, documents, charts violence across millennia, and, you know, he will argue very tightly that the present moment is a time of relative peace by comparison, but that's not to discount what's happening in the world right now. Ilaria Walker.
I'm not quite as optimistic as Sam, although I really do love to hear it. It's a really good antidote to the general mood. So two things make me optimistic. One is that although populism around the world has taken pretty nasty forms, particularly in the form of Trump, what I think that it has done is really highlighted the fact that the system isn't working for everyone. The income inequality that has created the rage that underlies populism is real. Capitalism doesn't work for most people. Those concerns, everyone has to take them seriously now. That extreme income inequality that has caused this polarisation, people just have to look at it now, both the left and the right, and I think that's a good thing.
And we're seeing that play out in the housing crisis in Australia, which is a genuine, devastating crisis right now. And the differentiation between the haves and have-nots is extraordinary.
Yeah. Yes, and I could talk about this for ages, but
yeah,
I won't. But
I
yes, it's like it's been going on the whole time and now everyone can see it.
Mm.
And the other thing is women. Last year in Poland, we saw a very rare instance of people going against the populist trend and voting out a sort of very authoritarian populist guy and voting in Donald Tusk, who is much more moderate. And a lot of the reason that that happened was because women just got so sick of their reproductive rights and other rights being compromised. And they turned out in unprecedented numbers. And I think that those people, I think women will play a role in the US election and can be quite sensible and don't like to have their rights eroded.
So we can be quite sensible, can't we?
So that gives me optimism.
What a fantastically interesting panel. Thanks for bringing your smarts and experience to it. Thank you so much. John, Sam, Ilaria. Bye. Thanks so much. Enjoy the rest of your festival.
Yes, thanks to journalist and ABC Foreign Affairs editor John Lyons, author of Balcony Over Jerusalem, a Middle East memoir, which has just been republished with a new updated edition. Sam Roggeveen, director of the Lowy Institute's International Security Program. He's author of The Echidna Strategy, Australia's Search for Power and Peace. And Ilaria Walker is the Asia Pacific editor at 360 Info, which is a global public interest journalism initiative out of Monash University. Check it out online. I'm Natasha Mitchell. You can join me at events that we're recording for Big Ideas like this one. Come along, love to see you. You can find out what's brewing by keeping an eye on the Be In Our Audience section over on our Big Ideas homepage, or you can join me on the ABC Listen app for 4 new podcast editions of Big Ideas every single week. So many big ideas to feast on and pointy thinkers. In the coming week, all sorts of truth-telling, including Anne Mann, by the way, who will be speaking about what she unearthed to write her new book, Crimes of the Cross, the Anglican Pedophile Network of Newcastle, its protectors and the man who fought for justice. Here's a glimpse.
Could it happen again? Well, here's what Steve thinks. He thinks that all you need is a weak bishop. All you need is a weak professional standards director. It would be harder now, but I want to draw attention to something that everybody needs to think about. That is, there's new work done on what are called powerful perpetrators. Graham Lawrence was one. Peter Rushton was one. In a way, George Parker was one. Jimmy Savile was another. Rolf Harris was one. I could just list them. So this new research looks at the underlying patterns and finds that many people climb to the top of abusers, climb to the top of an organisation, then use their VIP status to achieve what they call a halo effect, a beyond reproach effect. And that was what we saw time and again with Peter Rushton and Graham Lawrence, that people refused to believe there could be anything in this fine representative of the church, that anything they could have done wrong. And they are, powerful perpetrators are everywhere. They could be, for example, we've got something like 50,000 youth service organisations in Victoria. You would have to think that there could be the possibility of powerful perpetrators operating. I'm not saying 50,000 of them, but I'm saying in some of those organisations. And it's very clear that with people who are at the top of an organisation, they become, in a way, too big to fail. Like, the organisation attaches their status and their reputation to that person, so there's a desire to cover up. Even the things we've found coming out about private schools and their conduct, I don't think it's over. I think that it's better, but I don't think it's over.
Anne Mann on her new book, Crimes of the Cross. Look out for that on Big Ideas on the ABC Listen app in coming episodes. I'm Natasha Mitchell. I'll catch you next time.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.